Hello and welcome to Unlimited Realities. I'm your host, Lisa Zimmer, and I am just absolutely thrilled to be here with you today because I am loving the subject matter of today. I have renowned filmmaker Paul Davids here with us today, and he just launched a fascinating, groundbreaking documentary called Life After Death Project. And if you know me, and I get on my soapbox every once in a while, the two fascinating subjects for me are neuroscience and the afterlife. And so I am absolutely thrilled to be able to bring this to you today. We are offering, Paul is, I just spoke to him and he's calling through with another number. So he wants to get on a landline. And so what I'm going to do is I'm just going to talk about Paul till he comes on because this is such an exciting subject matter for me. Now, Paul Davids is quite renowned and has worked with among many documentary film ideas. And one of his very dear friends and mentors was Forrest J. Ackerman, who, if you recall, if you're a sci-fi buff, you will understand that Ackerman actually was one of the pioneering sci-fi filmmakers of our time. He, in fact, coined the phrase sci-fi. Fascinating man, a bit quirky, but you know I do like quirk. So this was just a really, really wonderful documentary. I urge all of you to go to www.lifeafterdeathproject.com to get a copy of this documentary. It is fascinating. And we have on here fascinating authors. Dr. Gary Schwartz, who is a professor studying in Arizona the body-mind-spirit connection, the afterlife experiments, the sacred promise of that we do have an afterlife that is here in our existence. We also have Danian Brinkley who comes on, and we have Michael Shermer, who is the skeptic on the documentary, who also disputes a lot of some of the phenomenon. But as you watch this documentary, skepticism is not something you really tap into on this. So without further ado, Paul, are you there on our...
I am. Good to talk to you this morning, Lisa.
Thank you so much for being my guest. I'm thrilled to introduce you to the audience today. Audience, without further ado, let me introduce to you renowned filmmaker Paul Davids, who has launched his fascinating, groundbreaking film on life after death in his Life After Death Project. Welcome, Paul. I'm thrilled to have you today.
Well, thank you very, very much. It's an exciting time for me because the movie was shown on the Sci-Fi Channel in May one time. Nationally, the DVD just came out 2 days ago. And actually, it's two DVDs because I've created a sequel for the Life After Death Project, too. And so now online, whether it's Amazon or Barnes & Noble or Target or Walmart, you know, wherever you go, you can find the Life After Death Project now. And at Amazon, it seems to have shot right up very quickly. There seems to be a lot of interest in it. So I spent 4 years on this project. It was a labor of love and a labor of truth.
Oh, it was amazing. And I'm going to go to Amazon and write a review for you. But let's talk a little bit about what inspired this, because it starts off with your inspiration was by your friend and mentor, Forrest J. Ackerman, who,
that's right, Forry
Ackerman is the pioneer of sci-fi films and coining the phrase, actually, sci-fi. He was an atheist. So when he passed in 2008, he jokingly told a few close friends, if he was wrong about the afterlife, he'd come pop in and drop a visit and drop a line. Well, after his death in 2008, in fact, those things started to happen. And here we are with this wonderful documentary that chronicles the individuals as well as scientists, doctors, researchers, psychics, lay people. And I love Danian Brinkley. How can you not love that gentle, loving soul?
Oh, it's wonderful that all these people participated. And, you know, I want to say right up front that when people hear, you know, the topic, which has to do with,
yes,
after-death communication, and it reminds them of mediums and seances, and which was sort of the forerunner of this, you know, starting a century ago or so, They want to have a knee-jerk reaction saying, you know, sounds tabloid. You know,
right.
It sounds like exploitation.
Right.
But in fact, there's no exploitation in the film. The film is true. Everything in it is honest. People want to say, well, is it a hoax? We've been through the Blair Witch Project. And the answer is no, it's not a hoax. It's not done for deception. It was done for the benefit of mankind and science, because
right.
when strange phenomena started to happen that I could peg related to the late Fari Ackerman, I got scientists involved. I went to Indiana University, the College of New Jersey, to talk to top forensic chemists to analyze evidence left behind in what seemed to be, you know, contacts, unexplained things that happened. In one case, a text that was altered when I was alone in the house, out of the room briefly, and I had seen the document. I knew it was normal. There was no question in my mind that I was alone. And immediately, when I got back into the bedroom where I had placed the document, I could see that there were four words blocked out, and the ink or whatever substance it was that was doing this was still moist. So it had just happened, and it was precise. It was exact. It was targeted. It was those four words clearly selected. So, you know, the knee-jerk reaction from, you know, skeptics is they say, well, look, did you check your ceiling? Was any water dripping? You know, did you have a leaky pen in your bed? It completely obscures the fact that this was precisely done. And it was the first thing the scientists noticed who looked at it, that those words were chosen. It was targeted. There was no one physically present who could have done it. And it was very soon after the great tribute for Fari Ackerman at the Egyptian Theater in Hollywood. Let me digress a moment, if I will, and pop in
sure.
for a question if you want to interrupt. But
sure.
I'd like your audience to know a little bit more about Fari Ackerman and why he's important and
yes.
why I got involved, why it was so meaningful to me. Because
okay.
you described Fari as a filmmaker. Although he was in quite a number of films in cameo roles, he was not really a filmmaker. He was an editor of the most popular magazine about science fiction, fantasy, horror, and monster movies. It started in 1958, that magazine, Famous Monsters of Filmland. Actually, Fari was born in 1916, so you're talking about a man who grew up in the era of the silent movies and saw the whole development of cinema and gravitated toward all of the films that had special effects, science fiction, horror, futurism, future vision of mankind. This is what he focused on. And he was a massive contributor in that field. And everyone who ever became a professional in that field, at one point or another, surely came into contact with Forrest J. Ackerman and his writings and his publications. He was like a Pied Piper for George Lucas and Steven Spielberg and Guillermo del Toro and Peter Jackson and John Landis, Dennis Muir, and Rick Baker. I mean, the list, it includes everyone working in the field today. They all knew him. I met him when I was a kid. I was, I think, 13 years old when I met him at a science fiction convention in Washington. And I was a kid making amateur movies, stop motion, special effects, dragons, dinosaurs. I love that kind of stuff from reading Famous Monsters. And the magazine was fun, and it was funny, and he had a great sense of humor. And so kids particularly, you know, loved him and his magazine. I turned out to be one of the winners in his amateur film contest then, way before video. This was the days of 8mm film.
Okay.
And I went on to college. I went to Princeton University. I studied psychology. But I always really wanted to work in film. And I applied to the American Film Institute, Center for Advanced Film Studies. It was the opening year of that institution in Beverly Hills. I was one of only 15 people accepted and was surrounded by the greats of Hollywood, many of whom are no longer with us, And that was how I found my way into the business. You know, I was a fellow student with people like David Lynch and Terrence Malick. You may not know Caleb Deschanel, you know, Zoe Deschanel. You know,
okay.
Her father is one of the great cinematographers. He was a student there. And while there, I got to know Fari so well. He lived in an 18-room house in the Las Feliz area of Los Angeles, and his house was like a museum. Every room, every corner, every wall packed with memorabilia from science fiction films. He had the original props, the monsters, Lon Chaney's makeup kit, masks galore, every poster you can imagine, all filed neatly, lobby cards, paintings. It was the only museum of its kind for decades. And so I would visit Fari. I wrote for him. He wrote a foreword for my first book. We were friends through the decades. And
okay.
you mentioned the fact he was a skeptic. He was an atheist. And he,
right.
He dismissed the possibility of life after death, but jokingly said, Paul, I'll drop you a line if it turns out that I wake up to some big science fiction convention in the sky. He said, but I doubt it, and don't count on it. And he said, besides, if that does happen, I'll be very busy having reunions with the great horror actors like Boris Karloff and Peter Lorre, and my dear friend Bela Lugosi. He wore Bela Lugosi's Dracula cape and his Dracula ring.
Wow.
And when you knocked on Fari's door to visit, a voice would come through his loudspeaker that would say, "Who dares disturb the sleep of the vampire?" And then he'd let you in. You know, he was a showman.
Right.
And the show, the biggest show of Fari's life, I think, started the day of his tribute, because even that day, there were two filmmakers from Canada who'd made a film about him, and they visited his crypt before the tribute. And they knocked on his crypt and said, "Hello, Uncle Fari." You know, in a playful mood, Fari was that kind of guy. You could do that. They wouldn't have
right.
done it with anybody else. And they swore that within an hour of that, they heard back from him. And he's deceased. And they
right.
explained how they heard back from him. It started with a CAPTCHA code on a computer. You want to blog onto Facebook, you want to post, a CAPTCHA code comes up. They want to know you're not a spammer, so you've got to spell out the letters and the numbers that have the squiggles. We've all done this, right?
Right, right.
So the CAPTCHA code was his name. It was Ackerman, 000. And if you just compute the odds of that happening by random chance, the other computer contributed to the mystery, because one of the filmmakers said, you know, is he really dead? The other computer blurted out with a voice, a childlike voice that you can find on YouTube. It's an emoticon, and it says, "Oh, my gosh, no way." The thing is, the computer was asleep. It wasn't logged onto YouTube. This didn't exist in the hard drive of the computer. So as Ian Johnston of Toronto said, he said, "Look, I'm a skeptic, but my computer had no business talking to me then."
Right.
It made that comment just after we saw his name. And imagine me. I'm a speaker, one of the many speakers at the tribute, in great company, because Ray Bradbury is speaking there, great friend
right.
of Fari, and Guillermo del Toro is there, and Peter Jackson checks in from New Zealand by video,
wow.
et cetera, et cetera. So for me, it's a week later when this ink blot happens. And so right, the timing was perfect for me to be receiving a message. And I didn't figure out what it meant immediately, but it did become crystal clear as I remembered Fari's love of puns and wordplay and word games and twists of words. He liked to find words within words and names within names. And in what he had blacked out, right in the middle of one of the words, was the name of the man who had been his caregiver for the last 10 years of his life. And he was telling me he spoke to this man. And when
Joe Moe.
Joe Moe. When I contacted Joe Moe, I hadn't figured out the meaning of the ink blot yet. And I was calling Joe to ask if he had old manuscripts of Fari so I could see how he blacked out words, how he crossed them out when he was editing. But Joe didn't even let me ask the question before he began telling me about this experience he, as a skeptic, had of having a virtual apparition of Fari coming to him. And he said it was, he says, moments before he woke up, but it wasn't like a dream. It was super real, and it was in his room he was seeing, and Fari was in his room, and Fari spoke to him and thanked him for the tribute in his own humorous, sly, mischievous sort of way. And then Joe opens his eyes, and everything he's seeing was exactly the same, but no more Fari there. So he said, "Paul, you know, was this real? It's like Fari came and spoke to me." And what's crossed out on my document is spoke to Jomo, okay? When you take the name that's within the name, because the name was Modi there, but that's exactly what Fari would do. I found 15 other examples where he did that with somebody's name inside a name. It was his trademark, you see. It was done in a way he, you know, I feel,
right.
This is my conclusion, he expected me to know it.
Right.
And this wasn't the end of the contacts. This was the beginning of very strange things that have continued for 4 years.
Wow.
4 years, and many of them tied directly to. So for the skeptics who don't believe there's any survival of personality after death,
right?
This case is a big challenge to them, and intended to be a big challenge to their point of view, because even Michael Shermer, probably the most famous skeptic in the U.S., as you mentioned, editor
right.
of Skeptic Magazine, author of books like The Believing Brain and Why People Believe Weird Things. You know, he's always looking for the, you want to know why people believe weird things? We got weird people, right?
Right.
Okay?
Right.
That doesn't work for me. That doesn't
right.
work for me. And he says, you know, it's always the believer who already believes that he'll see a sign. And he's the one who's jumping to the conclusion of turning something into a sign. You've got somebody who's a devoutly faithful in God, and he looks up at the sky and he sees clouds that look like an angel. That's the guy that'll think, oh, you know, God is sending me an angel, when it's
right.
water vapor in clouds, as any meteorologist
right.
would tell you. So that's Michael Shermer's objection. And what I say back to him is, look, so many of the people in my film, The Life After Death Project, were not believers in this. Something happened to them that caused them to come to these conclusions. They weren't looking for it. I wasn't
right.
looking for it. I wasn't expecting it. I've got many people in the film who are just absolutely taken by surprise in a life-changing way
right.
By contact from someone deceased who they knew. So, Lisa, I'm tired of science and skeptics throwing out this evidence, ignoring
right.
it, debunking it. You know,
I
James Randi says he'll give $1 million to anybody who
right.
can prove the paranormal. James Randi, I hope you're listening. You owe me $1 million.
Right.
You know,
right.
see the Life After Death Project, everyone. Please, you have to see
so
it
phenomenal.
To understand. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's one of these things, you know, there's so many, as you were saying, there's so many who dispute the afterlife, and this film begs to challenge that thought. But at the same point, we have so many people who have experienced so many things. And, you know, Danian Brinkley was a real validator for me because I experienced
yeah.
a near-death experience. And at that
you
time
did.
After going through it, I became much more intuitive after it. So for me, he is a real emotional resonance for me. And his authenticity across the board is so genuine, so from the
yeah.
soul, from the heart. You know, you can't look at him and say, what a BSer. You know,
Let me tell you about him a little bit, you know, because he's in the film. And I want to just say first, Lisa, there's many ways you can study life after death. And the
right.
NDE, the near-death experience, is one of them, which you're talking about now. The electronic phenomena, EVP, electronic voice phenomena.
I am very interested in that. Yes.
And
so
ITC, instrumental transcommunication, reincarnation, apparitions, manifestations, apportations. The field is vast for study, But with the near-death experience and Danian, he wrote Saved by the Light, which was a big bestseller. What he says is he was like a young kid in his 20s, early 20s, growing up in a southern state. I think it was Georgia. And he said that he was a bully and a jerk at that point of his life. And he says he was a jackass. And he was struck by lightning. And he was clinically dead for a half an hour. They took him to the hospital. They found no EKG, not breathing, no heartbeat, no pulse. They tied one of those things on your big toe, you know. It says your next stop is going to be the morgue.
Right.
And he comes back about a half an hour later, and he's been in heaven. He tells the story very lucidly. There is an afterlife. They told me I had to go back. And so he's back, and he is joined by, it's got to be, I won't put a number on it, many, 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 many people have had this experience like you have, Lisa.
Yes.
The best book on the subject of the last year, bestseller, New York Times bestseller, is by Dr. Eben Alexander.
Yes,
Proof
love
of
that
Heaven.
Book. Yes.
Proof of Heaven. Neurosurgeon, yeah. So the field advances, new research, great research coming out of University of Arizona, Dr. Gary Schwartz.
Right.
I'd like to tell you about him. He's in my film.
He's wonderful. I have his books, and I've read him for many years. I think he's phenomenal too. So let's
can
talk
I tell
about
you
Dr.
he
Gary
and I
Schwartz.
He and I are writing a he, we have begun to write a book together now about my Fari Ackerman case.
Oh, I want both of you on my show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's co-authored. We're beginning. I'm putting together a timeline of all the events that have happened over 4 years. And it's
awesome.
More than 50 things at this point, you know.
Wow.
More than 50. And I never know when – I can't expect anything's going to happen. I never know when anything's going to happen. It's just I'm living my ordinary life and something – really bizarre happens that just is so strange.
Right.
And sometimes there's evidence and other people contest it and see it. Like when Fate magazine published an article about this I wrote, they proofread it. The editor proofread it. The publisher, they have another proofreader. It goes to the press. When it comes back, the first page is all garbled and it has doubling up these lines that were not there at the beginning of my article. It wasn't even the way I wrote it. Talking about the ink blot with two levels of opacity. Oh, that means opaqueness. In other words,
right.
The words were blacked out in two levels of darkness. And it says the word spoke to Joe Imhotie, repeated, where I didn't even write it in the article.
Wow.
And it's an article about Fari, with a cover story about one of his favorite artists, Frank R. Paul, science fiction illustrator of the pulp magazines. It's like, how did it happen? And the skeptic wants to say, well, you know, they had a glitch at the printer. You know, these things happen. Don't get excited about it. And I would reply, look, I wouldn't get excited about one incident, but when 50 things are happening to you over 4 years and some other people too, if you're not willing to make a leap to connect the dots, I think you're being foolish. You know, they don't want you to connect the dots. They don't want you to jump to conclusions.
Right.
Okay. Michael Shermer says, look, weird things will happen to people, one-off events. You can't explain them. Doesn't mean there's a paranormal reality. Doesn't mean there's an other side or a veil to pierce. Don't connect them in your own mind. You can't prove they're connected. Put them in a gray basket and leave it there until science is ready to deal with it, right?
Right.
Well, I say the day for science to deal with it is today, okay?
Amen. Yes. It's a field that it's almost as if it's the Holy Grail on some level, because we have this at our disposal, and it is this kind of a dimensional field that we're looking at. We're looking over this bridge into this other dimension, and it is this veil. However, we as people, want proof, and that's how our society encourages and validates. And yet, this is a feeling. This is a knowing. This is an emotional awareness. And when you have a knowing that is in your core, in your soul, there isn't a definable fact with it. There's something that is ethereal. It's out there. It's an energy. And so energy, let's get into a little bit of detail here. I was fascinated to learn about the ITC and the EVP, and the EVP being a European study of electronic voice phenomenon. Can we talk a little bit about that? Because that is just a mind blower.
Yes. Well, these studies go back, and I'm not going to remember everybody's name who was involved originally, but I know that there were priests who were making recordings, and voices were showing up when they didn't belong there. And there was somebody who was recording birds, making large numbers of nature tapes, and heard voices that he recognized, and deceased people that he knew. And actually, the priests involved with this took the information to whoever was Pope at that time, who gave his blessing and sanctioned the research and said, this is, further confirmation of what we believe, that there is a soul that goes on. Many people have done efforts with EVP using tape recorders or video cameras. I had an incident of EVP while making the film. One incident. It would take a while to go into all the details, but briefly, the day after the inkblot incident, I had the house checked out with an electromagnetic field reader. And right around the wall from the room where this happened, I had on display an African mask from Zimbabwe that was danced in a ceremony there. And this mask with no metal parts was giving off very intense EMF readings. It was very strange, and it hasn't happened again in the same spot, but it sure did that day. And while we were filming that, this is in the movie too, there was a voice that was discernible on the audio of the video, a voice that said one word, and that was Lenore. Now, this is pretty weird that there's nobody in the house that would have said that, and you're there listening to it, and you hear Lenore.
Right.
Lenore makes me think of Edgar Allan Poe. He wrote a famous poem called Lenore, and Lenore is the lost love in his poem The Raven. And Fari Ackerman, coincidentally or not coincidentally, was a tremendous fan of everything Edgar Allan Poe wrote.
That's so interesting, because in the cover, I looked at the cover picture and I thought, there's Edgar Allan Poe with the raven. And I had no idea.
And the cover picture on our DVD is Fari making a shush gesture like the silence of the night, beware the children of the night. And he has on his Bela Lugosi ring. The ring that after it was auctioned in Los Angeles, by the way, over a course of a year, it mysteriously travels 4,000 miles to Halifax, where the film director from Canada who knocked on Fari's crypt that day is living. And it shows up a couple hundred feet from his front door in the window of a display in a gallery there for one day, Fari Ackerman's Bela Lugosi ring. But getting back to EVP, when Hollywood tackles these subjects, they often are so exploitative. I mean, when they did Signs, they had to add horror into it about the crop circles. And when they did White Noise, which was about EVP, they had to turn it into a horror movie. They're in the business of shocking. So I think that's unfortunate, but there have been many studies, many examples, and some of them are more persuasive than others. Sometimes people will hear noises in the tape and read words into it or want to play the tape backwards, and think they're finding things, but other people can't really hear it the same way. But other times there are examples, like my Lenore, where really everybody's going to say, oh, I hear that. I hear that. How did that get there? So this leads us back to Gary Schwartz we were going to talk about.
Yes.
His research. Because EVP comes under the category of ITC, instrumental transcommunication. Communication to the other side using our technology, our instrumentation. The computer with Ackerman 000, you know, is one example of that. Gary Schwartz, who was a Harvard graduate, then a Harvard professor, then a Yale professor in psychology, psychiatry, medicine, surgery, et cetera, et cetera. He then became a full professor at University of Arizona, Tucson, where he has a laboratory. He is supported in this research by the university. For a lot of the 15 years or so he's been studying this, he focused on mediums, wanting to differentiate those who think that they're channeling and that they're mediums, but they're not. They're some are pretenders, some are hoaxers, some are, you know, the field is riddled.
Unfortunately.
With problems.
God, is it riddled. Yeah.
Yeah, it's terribly riddled.
However, it's horrible.
What Gary, I think, has proven, and he's certainly proven it to me, is that there are some individuals who do have...
Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Unlimited Realities with Lisa Zimmer. I'm Lisa, and I'm here to introduce Jeff Brown, author of Soul Shaping, who today we're going to have a bit of a humorous show, hopefully enlightening, hopefully humorous. We're introducing Vinnie Brownerini, let me get it right, and he's the evolving male who's coming from a place of really wanting to open up his heart, really wanting to show who he is and his essence, struggling with all of life and what life has to throw at him and in his thoughts and how he proceeds. So first let me introduce author of Soul Shaping, Jeff Brown. Jeff, thanks for being here.
Pleasure. Lisa, always a pleasure to connect with you.
Well, it's always a pleasure to have you on as well. You're such a light. And now we're going to introduce a real fun guy, no mushroom, but fun. And his name's Vinnie Brownerini. And we're going to first get into the apologies of the divine feminine, because really Vinnie kind of resonated with this and really felt moved and compelled to come out of hiding after this was published and went online. So I'm going to begin with reading a little bit of the Apologies of the Divine Feminine, and then we'll get into some questions and dialogue. How's that sound, Jeff?
That sounds good. Vinnie's not really happy with the way you introduced him, but we'll get to that later.
We'll get into Vinnie after a few parts of this apology. How
making
about that?
Noises. Yeah, okay.
You know, well, I hear him back there. You know, I hear him. I figure he's clearing his voice and getting ready there. So I figured I'd give him a few moments.
Well, he's spinning something up. I don't know what he's doing. Yeah, we'll find out.
Had a rough night,
sure.
Eh?
Yeah, he did. He fell into old habits, didn't you? Yeah, he did.
Well, you know, old habits are meant to be broken. So, they're, you know, it's good to come up, rising to the top.
If only he'd look at them.
So in dealing with... I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, let's start with the apology.
Okay, here we go with the apologies to the divine feminine. And this is from a warrior and in transition.
Yes.
I apologize for my inability to distinguish the benevolent warrior from the heartless warrior, a reflection of my own confusion dealing with the battlefields of yore. When I opened my heart too wide, I was vulnerable to attack from warring factions, and I was conditioned to believe that I had to stay rigid, focused, prepared for any eventuality. In the desire to protect myself and others from the attack, but I went too far and closed too tight and eradicated the bridge between our hearts. I am seeing this now, and I am sorry. I apologize for my perpetual absence, a reflection of my own inner absence, my inability to to connect from a heart jammed tight by unresolved emotions that I did not have the tools to work through. I still lack many of these tools, but I'm open to their emergence. All right, I'm going to stop there, Jeff. So,
okay.
Just in dealing with that little piece of the apology,
yeah.
Was that coming from a place of a past knowing? Was that coming from a place of understanding for the first time what a benevolent warrior and a heartless warrior were?
Well, I don't know. I think that, I think a lot of the apology was lodged in my experience in this lifetime, you know. I mean, I had a lot of glimpses and developed kind of a witnessing capacity to recognize my own warrior nature. You know, it appeared really early in my life, in my childhood, fighting forever with that my family, and kind of choosing that path rather than avoiding it or sidestepping it. And then as my journey unfolded, you know, it became clear that I had sort of archetypal history, it seemed, some kind of past life carryover, something threaded through me that was... had experience, particularly of malevolent warrior, and it just became clear that my movement in this lifetime was not to shed warrior, although that was where what I thought was going to happen, but really more to kind of meld my warrior into something more heartfelt, in the direction of more benevolent warrior. So I don't know, I think this whole apology came from some combination of archetypal experience and some kind of sacred transmission, and definitely my personal experience, that's for sure, yeah.
Okay, so can I ask Vinny some questions here? Is he ready to be introduced and come to the forefront here?
Hi, Lisa.
Vin, how you doing?
I had a rough night.
Did you?
I fell back into what Jeff calls an old pattern.
Well, you know, Vinny, don't beat yourself up, because these things happen, and they come up for reasons that we need to explore and really just kind of like merge through it. So don't beat yourself up over it, Vinny.
No, I went too far. Yeah. It's okay, though.
Well, Vinny, how do you see yourself? Do you see yourself as the heartless warrior or the benevolent warrior, a little bit of a combo of the two?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's a very fine line. You know, I mean, I think it's very difficult to have a man go out into the world and deal with the marketplace and the warring nature of humanity and always stay connected to his heart and with his actions. It's how do you do that? How do you put on your armor and get yourself into a state like a snorting bull ready to take on the world to protect yourself and others? And then always remember not to go too far. I think this is a very unrealistic expectation.
And I think that, you know, you're right, because in so many ways, you know, we are, as a society, trying to tweak man. And, you know, instead of tweaking man, I think that there's a real need to really accept and embrace the man. And yet, at the same point, there's that little piece of man that's also, you know, wanting to evolve. And as you have experienced yourself, Vinny, an evolving soul, an evolving heart. So, you know, as you're going through this evolution, do you feel that, you know, that you can go in? I mean, I know that it's hard. It's hard to, like, stay centered in that heart. It's hard to, like, come from there constantly. But do you feel like you're able to go there when need be, that, you know, when something really triggers you emotionally, you're able to tap into that a little easier? And what does that feel like? Is it uncomfortable for you? Is it something that you're getting used to? Is it something that is foreign and you're having to kind of learn as you go?
Well, you know, I don't like to diss the man, you know, because I think what's happened in the feminist movement is that we went very far. In Jeff's latest apology, he spoke to that, the pushing, you know, the man down, not honoring that which was good about him. And so for me, as I mean, I'm in psychotherapy now, so
good
I'm...
Good for you.
I'm dealing with some of my emotional things, but at the same time, I'm still allowing myself to be in like the healthier parts of my masculinity in the way that I move through the world, because I think that it's important to honor the man while, you know, at the same time working to change some of our patterning.
Amen. That's beautifully stated, and quite an evolved statement, Vinny. It's you've come a long way with the psychotherapist. I'm quite impressed.
Well, I help her too. You know, I help her too because she's stuck in that too. You know, and I call her on that, and she thanks me for that too. Because, you know, I remember how my papa used to be, and even though he was edgy and had to handle the boys and had to handle this business, which was not always clean, I admit that to be true, but at the same time, he took care of us in a very loving way. He made us French fries on Sunday mornings. He did things to show his love for us, so it's more complicated than people think.
Well, and it's also, you know, there's that piece of I really agree with the feminist movement pushing it a little too far, because it left men kind of really confused about where their role was and how they really defined themselves. So I think it actually pushed men further down into hiding their heart and hiding themselves. And then you have, you know, the feminine movement, which supported strong women, and dear God, I mean, in a world of strong women and men, you know, fearful of expressing their heart, where do we go with that? Right?
No.
Jeff,
no.
Help me.
Nowhere to... Oh. Hold on. No, I think
where do we go with a man who's really trying to come out like Vinny and yet at the same point not really being supported by society or his peer group or his friends, because, you know, Vinny's from a traditional role of personalities that are very dominant in their masculinity, and he really wants to, you know, come out a little bit with his heart. So there's not a lot of support for Vinny, you know, in his environment.
Yeah.
How does he seek support? How does he get support? Where can he go besides a psychotherapist?
Well, Vinny and I talk a lot, you know. I mean, you know, too much, actually, but it's not that easy. He found his way into psychotherapy, which I think is very important for him to get support for the process. He also gets a lot of body work. You know, he gets a lot of deep tissue work because at some point he recognized that there was some connection between the armoring in his physical body and the armor around his emotional body. And I think that's a very important part of the process. So he gets touched and he gets relaxed and he gets open. So he has an experience of something softer or more surrendered or more receptive, you know, than his edge. You know, some of the things that helped me, you know, I did a lot of bioenergetics. So I did a lot of anger work. You know, it's not about like getting rid of all of those intense emotions. It's about learning how to move from a more benevolent source spring. So, for example, instead of acting out in the direction of somebody in your immediate environment, you get a cube in your house and you have a bat and you move anger like bioenergetics people do by hitting the foam cube, for example. You know, so you start to shift it in realistic and subtle directions in a way that's less harmful and actually allows you to have the kind of release that doesn't lead to more guilt and shame after the fact, you know? You know, and he's doing that. He's still a snorting bull, but not as often as he used to be. Yeah.
No, and he's quite gentle, having had a rough night and all. I mean, he's coming across really with a very soft and open heart, and it's really appreciated for the show and in interviewing him. It's great. Hey, Vinny, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here, Lisa. I'm always here.
Vinny,
always here.
Do you feel that you're developing tools, whether it's through the psychotherapist or actually your perceptional changes as you're viewing life and things, your feelings, other people, connections to others? Do you feel like you're developing more tools to really bring out that authentic heart and that truth that, you know, kind of has stayed buried for eons and is encouraged to stay buried with environment as well?
Well, first, Lisa, let me say, you know, like, I like you. You know that. But, you know, in a way you're sort of talking a little, implying like, you know, I'm a dinosaur who has to change all these things. So I get a little defensive. I am now able to spot that and admit that to you here, you know.
Okay.
I do feel as though I am growing. You know, I am growing in the directions of being more communicative with some measure of subtlety, you know. Whereas before, if somebody asked me these questions, I would have just said, fuck you, and got off the phone, right? So now I am here. I stay in the process with you, right? You know, I use words like process, you know. I mean, they annoy me. A lot of times the words Jeff uses annoy me. But at the same time, there is a part of me that, like, recognizes that they have some merit, a little bit of merit, you know. So, for example, my kid pissed me off the other day. And so whereas before I would have just flung the breakfast at him. I mean, I was so annoyed with what he did. But instead, I go for a walk. I play some tennis. I move my anger. So when I talk to him, have an interface later in the day, I'm more available to it. You know, like that. Like that. It's small steps. It has to be small steps.
It is small steps. And that's really how it really starts to implement and stay stuck within our being, you know. All right, so I know that this is probably going to be one of those questions that pisses you off, and you may get a little defensive on it, but I'm going to go with it anyway because, hey,
okay.
You know, then, you know, we understand each other. We're coming from the same place here.
I respect your courage.
Hey, okay, well, you know, there's a phone between us. You're not going to throw any scrambled eggs and peppers and onions at me here. All right, so in regard to... you, Vin, as a virile, you know, man who really likes women.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're getting into the real heart of who you passionately are. And as you are, like, you know, moving through your dances with females, do you feel yourself going to a point of changing how you approach women or how you are interacting with women, I should say? Because, you know, before, you know, when we spoke eons ago and you were just taking your baby steps here with evolution, there was a whole lot of carefreeness. And I've seen as Vinny has evolved over these months here that you've really got more of a compassionate side to the female gender and more of an honoring of the female. So have you really, like, looked at how you interact as differently and now from your past and how they react to you?
Well, like last night, I go out with a dame. We go out for dinner. You know, I like to go out for dinner with dames. So we go to a restaurant for fish, and I'm you know, she asked me, what am I looking for in relationship? You know, so what's changed is I'm more direct. I say, I'm just looking for some intimacy, but I'm not looking for an attachment right now, you know. And I think she appreciated that, you know, like that. That was, I was, you know, whereas, of course, in the old days, I would have said anything to get into her panties, you know. But then I fell back into an old pattern, which is that I started to drink, and I wanted to out-drink her and show her I could handle my alcohol. And we were only drinking Bailey's, I'm almost embarrassed to admit. But, so it's like I go back and forth between the old way and the new way, and I haven't quite found the bridge between them.
But are you getting, you know, obviously you've evolved quite a bit for you to be so direct and honest, and I find that, you know, that's really refreshing, because the majority of, you know, poor relationship aspects comes from a lack of communication and basically just spouting what you think the other person wants to hear, not really coming from the truth or the heart. So, you know, a little Bailey's. I mean, Vinny, give yourself a break here. You know, it kind of brought out the little, you know, soft heart there. It was a good thing.
Yeah.
But,
well, you know,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I remember, I thought I should say this before because I'm forgetting things lately, that I remember when I started to practice, Jeff calls it, you know, practice, being more direct, honest, I remember that it was almost like physically impossible for me to speak from that place. It was, I remember feeling as though the way that I had maneuvered through the marketplace in this competitive economic world too was with trickery and deception. It was like how I survived. So then to speak from a more genuine place, I didn't know, you know, I didn't understand, I had nothing, I didn't survive that way. So it felt almost like physically impossible to do it. It's something that needs to be practiced for people who've been in the survivalist, what Jeff calls survivalist vibration, you know.
Mm-hmm. But at the same point, look at how far you've come. And and at this, at that point, you also have to look at, you know, okay, you were in the survivalist mentality. You were taking care of what needed to be taken care of. And as you opened up your heart, your priorities shifted. So truth was even that much more important to you. And it was it's so much simpler to get really some clarity when there's such open communication and truth between, you know, relationships, intimate relationships especially, because, you know, there's all those assumptions and mind games that come out and get played. And, you know, women come from one place notoriously and men notoriously come from 180 degrees different. And it's very difficult to meet in the middle. It's very, unless there's that open trust of communication where you can just say what you need to say and know that it's not going to be ridiculed or judged or condemned. And it took you a while to get out of that survivalism to get to that part. But that's really a blessing when you did. I mean, did you feel a relief? Did you feel like a weight was lifted off your shoulders in regard to being able to be so free with who you are?
No, I find it, mostly I find this annoying work that I'm doing. It's mostly feels, I feel as though I have somewhere an inkling that it's one day going to feel good, but I don't experience the joy of it. I enjoy the game, and a lot of dames that I know, you know, it depends what circles you travel in. So a lot of dames I know are part of they manipulate more than anybody. So we're all in this gig together, and you know, what gets lost in the translation with all the judging is that sometimes the game is fun. We know it's a game, but we enjoy
right.
the game. And so sometimes I just want to enjoy the game. And, you know, how far can one person shift in one generation? I mean, it's at some point it becomes you're stretching your canvas so far that it's not a you're too confused in your own bones as to who you are. So you go a little bit out, but not too far before you got to come back to what you know too.
Right. You have to be true to who you are. And that's, you know, but,
sure.
but even in being true to who you are, there's still your ability that you did stretch it quite a bit. I mean, okay, it's one generation that you expanded upon, but just think of that influence that you're going to have for your kids. You know, your kids are going to look at you as, you know, hey, you know, dad's not flinging the sausage as much, you know?
Yeah.
He's
so,
not,
so to speak,
he's not
so
throwing
to speak.
Dinner on the floor.
Yeah. I know,
but at the same, go
I
ahead.
Mean, but what, at least, you know, I'm feeling a little revolt here, because what about the dames? I mean, you know, you're talking.
Oh yeah, well,
like,
let's get into
it's
the
always
dames,
about
because...
the men and the men this and the men that. Well, we're in this together. We created this.
All right. Well,
together.
Let's talk about the dames.
You know, have
point.
You not been
think,
manipulative in your life? Of course, you know, what changes have
oh,
you made?
Oh, I think,
you know?
Okay, then let's get into the dames. I have some great insight in regard to women because, you know, you guys
right.
have gotten a bad rap. I mean, I am a big supporter of men being men. I really am. I don't want a mate for me to be like me or a woman. I want him to be a man. So I really think you have, as men, as a gender, been really crushed. And women are masters of manipulation. There are no women. There's nothing a man could do that could outsmart a woman's manipulation. And I know this because I've worked with women almost 25, 30 years now, and they all have different patterns and paths, whether it's a seductive manipulation or whether it's a woe is me, I'm such a victim manipulation, or it's, you know, twisting
yeah.
words and comments to get
yeah.
their way or their needs met or validated on some way. So, you know, there's a whole lot of crap that women do notoriously that, you know, that this whole passive aggression, this whole passive aggressive approach to things is manipulation, and that's handed down generations upon generations of repressed women and mothers and the matriarch figures. So you've got, you know, I hear you, Vinnie, and my heart does go out to you because it can't be easy, especially in the environment you mix with, to really just tap in, drop in, and be real, because it is a game, and it's been a game that's played for longer than the truth has come out. So, you know, we're kind of used to playing a game if we're not evolved, and that's an awakening.
Can you get me a
So,
movie?
You
get
know, had, I'm yeah. sure, Vinny, you've met many women who have, you know, pulled at you or, you know, flaunted or enticed or, you know, played their little manipulative games, and it can be a little, it can be, you know, something that you can play with, but all of a sudden when they turn it around and look at it as serious, the game's no longer a game. Have you ever experienced something
Hold
like
on.
That, Vin?
Hold on, I'm just trying to get a cannoli. Get me the big one. I tell you a story quickly, that maybe is what you mean. I was with this woman once, and she was amazingly hot. I mean, she was hot in all the ways that I like hot. And she knew what to say and what to do. And, I mean, you really believe she was, like, really, like, loved you so much, you know. And I remember that I dropped down and opened my heart with her, and I was revealing some of the things I was guilty about, some of the organized crime things, different things that I don't talk about with anyone other than my psychotherapist. And then all of a sudden she disappears. About 3 months later, I'm at a bar with some guys, and some guys there, and he starts telling a story about a woman. And for a while I don't get it. He's saying the exact same lines. That every line, and I say, was it who? And I don't want to mention her name here on the radio, but exact same woman, using the exact same lines. I mean, you know, she was a public figure, so we don't need to get into that. But the point is, she had all like a book of lines that she was using on different men to hook them in to get sex and money. So,
they've written books like that.
Yeah,
there's books out there like that.
Absolutely, and so I come back to this. Of course, men in the warrior way went too far with various violent, horrible things. Of course, first of all, that has to be addressed, you know. But once we get to the next step in the way we relate on a normal day-to-day level, we're all full of shit, as far as I'm concerned. And we really all need to talk from that place and talk about what happened, how this got created. You know, if we're going to change it, we need to be honest, and we need to express our anger and then get past that and start understanding what happened to this humanity, you know.
Right, right. And stop bashing the genders. And, you know, the one thing I see being a woman is it's been a really common thread among women. When they're in their little women's groups, that, you know, male bashing, it has become almost like a unspoken bonding session. And even little comments like, oh, he'll never get it, he's a man, or, you know, well, what do you expect, he's a man, you know, it encourages that separation. And even if it's something that you say in fun, or it's something that you say, you know, to kind of commiserate with your fellow sisters. It's something that is in the back of your head somewhere that's planted, that